Thanks, guys. That was awesome. I'm Jeff. Welcome, everyone. And for those that are new here, glad you're here, too. You braved the cold to be here. I want to ask you a question. Do you remember ever, even as a young kid, being really freaked out, like, for your own life, like, afraid? Maybe for you, for your family? Do you remember ever looking back and there's a moment where you're just like, something really bad could happen? I was about 11. I was in my room, and I was freaked out of my mind. Freaked out of my mind. This might sound surprising, but I had just come back from church. Maybe not so freaked out, or surprised. I had just been to church, and they had a movie night that night. And they showed two movies. Now, I don't know how many of you have had any experience with what I'm talking about, but these movies were, they were end times movies. Okay, I see some head nods. Some of you maybe go back into that realm. One was called Distant Thunder, another one was called Thief in the Night. And these things, man, they were like Christian horror flicks. It was based, apparently, on someone's interpretation of the book of Revelation. And in the movie, there was this evil leader, the Antichrist, who had instructed uniformed soldiers to be going door to door, forcing people to either accept the mark of the beast, 666, on their, remember that? For those that watch, on the forearm, or... Which by doing so, if you took on the mark, basically you're denying your faith in God, jeopardizing your own soul to be banned to hell. You either take the mark or you go to the guillotine. This was just a fun family movie night at the church. I came home that night and I am rattled. Because the separation between fact and fiction is really blurry for an 11-year-old. It was not pitched like this was fiction at the church. This was like, hey, folks, bad times are coming. Man, I went home that night, and I remember looking out my window, watching for armed guards to start moving down the street. I was freaked out. Thankfully, the soldiers never showed up, all right? Just so you know, I'll finish the story there. The soldiers never came. But because of that experience, for many years growing up, I didn't want to open and read the book of Revelation. I didn't want to be reminded again of the horror that could potentially be awaiting us at any moment when that end of the world came. I didn't want to look in there, be reminded of that story that paralyzed me as a young kid. Now, I realized later, much later in life, that these movies came from a very particular reading, a way of reading the book of Revelation. Presupposed in this way of reading that book is the belief that this book contains knowledge of the future that was somehow communicated way back in the past. And if you just decode the rich imagery and the cryptic language, you will be able to figure out how the world is exactly going to play out in the end. If you've watched any Christian television, likely you've stumbled across some stations where some guys specialize in being able to decode. And they tell you right now, based on what just happened over in Israel or Russia, this or that, this is how it's playing out. We are in the final days. There's a particular way of reading the book of Revelation that leads you to that. A few things on that. This way of reading the book of Revelation hasn't been around a long time. It hasn't always been read that way. Number two, it's not the only way of reading the book of Revelation. Number three, I don't personally see Revelation as a tool to foretell the future. Just going to be straight up with that. Now, if you are here this morning and you see the book of Revelation that way, that's cool. That is absolutely cool. You just need to know that this series and our approach here isn't going to be from that perspective. We want to delve into the book of Revelation, but we're not going to be reading it as a tool to foretell the future. We want to read it narratively. We want to look at it and understand more about how it can speak to our lives, but through an understanding of maybe what was going on back then. And we do this all the time. We read through these Bible passages and stories narratively. But I'm going to warn you at the same time, the language in this book is cryptic. It is difficult. In fact, there are many passages right now. When you read through, we got books coming out of our ears right now, reading through all these different people and their takes, these scholars, their takes on certain passages. There's chunks, they're just like, yeah, we got nothing on that one. So we're gonna be honest about that too. We can't totally figure this thing out. In many ways, it's kind of like the song that Amanda and the band just sang. I don't know if you were sitting there going, okay, what is this song about? Dog days are over. If you read through the lyrics of that Florence and the Machine song, I went online just saying, hey, tell me what this song means. And the comment section and the different takes, and everyone votes on what they think this thing is about. But I mean, the versions, the translations people have when they listen to that song and the different lyrics and the imagery that that song creates, the interpretations are unbelievably diverse. Revelation can be a lot like that. And in fact, in some ways, it's the beauty of it, because you take this language, you go, well, it could mean this, could mean this. You wish you could just go and sit down with the Florence and the Machines, just say, okay, tell us what you were thinking when you wrote that song, Dog Days. Oh, well, this is where, and everyone else was going, what? That's where that came from? You broke up with your girlfriend. Okay, all right, I get it now. All right, jeez, that's boring. But, you know, it's nice, because then all of a sudden you go, oh, okay, I get where you're coming from. I liked my definition of what that song was about better, but I get where you're coming from. Revelation doesn't afford us that opportunity. We don't get to go back to the author, John, and go, okay, what were you getting at on this point? But if we go back historically, it can cast a lot clearer of a picture of what they might have been doing. That's what we want to do. So this morning, by doing that, I think what I have found anyways is I've jumped into this book, and the two pieces that I'm going to talk about this morning, I'm amazed at just how provocative the learning can be, and actually how this cryptic book can actually speak to my life today. I think it will speak to yours too. This morning, what I've done is I'm going to unpack two different letters. The first part of the book of Revelation, actually, there's a collection of seven letters that were sent to seven different churches. I want to cover two of them. They're written to two different churches by a figure that I mentioned. His name is John. And he wrote it from a vision that he had. And in the vision, it seemed like there was a figure a lot like Jesus, who was the voice writing these letters. He was the person saying, this is what I want you to say in this letter. Does that make sense? So let me begin with the church, the letter to the church of Smyrna. This is how it starts. I know about your suffering and your poverty, but you are rich. I know the blasphemy of those opposing you. They say they are Jews, but they are not, because their synagogue belongs to Satan. Well, that makes complete sense, doesn't it? What could be going on here? Let's start by just looking at the city of Smyrna. When I first read those words, suffering and poverty, I don't know about you, but in my mind, I picture maybe it's like a small village that is impoverished and poor. But actually, what we know of Smyrna back in this time was that it was a very elegant, a very well-planned and prosperous city that stretched down the slopes of a mountain, down onto a plain that stretched out to a harbor that brought in a ton of commerce to the area. It was beautiful. Beautiful. But the Christian community, the church there in Smyrna, was poor by comparison. You see, there was this cultural hostility that was growing between the Christians, not so much between the Christians and the Romans, as I would have assumed, who were kind of running the joint, but by other locals, especially the Jewish community. It was affecting the Christians economically and relationally. The letter mentions blasphemy of those opposing the Christians. It says, they say they're Jews, but they aren't. Their synagogue belongs to Satan. This comment starts highlighting this conflict. More of a family fight that had to do with the question of who were the true Jews. Now you can tell, can't you, that the author is implying that actually he and the group he's speaking to are the true Jews, aren't they? They're the legitimate representation of Israel's tradition. They're the real ones. The others, though, it seems aren't convinced. There's another group that are going, you guys aren't, we are. In that day, being a true Jew was a very important matter, very important. If you weren't one, it could prove costly. Let me explain. As the Christian community began to emerge, and remember, they were all Jews at one point. And then all of a sudden, Jesus shows up on the scene. Then his followers start seeing something about him. They weren't trying to say, oh, we don't want to be Jews anymore. It wasn't like that. But it started growing into this movement where he started questioning different things that they'd always done. And it grew into this swelling movement where people were going, man, there's things that maybe we've been doing. We got to think this through. And this Christian movement started growing and growing. As the Christian community began to emerge from the Jewish community, the non-Christian Jews, they began to define their community a little more narrowly. They're not just saying, oh yeah, we're all Jews. No. Some of you are Christians. You're not Jews. You're Christians. They started defining it a little more narrowly. People who are called Christians, the people who are calling Jesus as their Lord, were being excluded. Apparently, there was starting to be a lot more slander, kind of subtly, in the community. Some had a very informal letter. Hey, did you know Leo? He's a Christian. What? Leo? Yeah. Come on. When did that happen? I don't know. I like that guy. All of a sudden, Leo's phone stops ringing from certain clients that were always getting him to help with certain stuff. All of a sudden, Leo's finding out about a party that happened. He wasn't invited. He was always invited to those parties. Leo and his family walk into a kind of a public setting, and it just feels like people are talking. You ever felt that? You look around and people are looking at you. Things have changed. Something's changed. Sometimes it rose beyond just that kind of subtle slander to a very serious level. And it entered the realm of these public denunciations. Have you heard of these? It was like a legal proceeding. And in that day, it was common when someone had done enough. Some people were pretty ripped off at them. They'd bring a complaint. They'd bring an accusation to the officials, the government. They go, you got a problem over here and you better deal with this guy. Oftentimes, cases were being brought against the Christians who refused to engage in some of the civic activities, the Roman festivals. Especially the ones where they felt like it was violating their religious convictions. Now, what's weird is the Jews did the exact same thing. There were many things that the Romans were doing. They had these big parties. But the Jews said, well, our religion says we can't partake of this. And their religion was so old that they kind of got off the hook. But Christians, they were this new thing. Jews could easily just kind of point them out and go, did you notice? They're not wanting to do anything with you guys. Weird how this began to happen. And all of a sudden, these Christians, like level of commerce, social credibility, everything just started to drop, being pushed out, marginalized. According to Tacitus, a Roman historian, the Christians were accused of promoting a new and mischievous superstition, which the non-Christian Jews presented as a threat to the social order. So the author of the book of Revelation, in this letter, it says, don't be afraid of what you are about to suffer. The devil will throw some of you into prison to test you. You will suffer for 10 days, but if you remain faithful, even when facing death, I will give you a crown of life. As a result of the denunciations, the letter of Smyrna challenges these Christians, don't be afraid. There's some rough times coming here. Warning about this devil. Now, from all the reading that I've done, no one has a real clear definitive answer on what that thing was. But from all the reading I did, the sense is it's not so much this spiritual demonic being like you maybe picture with horns and a pitchfork. We're not talking about that kind of thing. Most are convinced that it referred to the Roman authorities who wielded huge power over them. Unlike today, prison wasn't so much a place where you'd be given a sentence and you go and do your time, 5 years, 10 years. No, prison was a place where they would go to break you. If you were defiant, you were trying to show some kind of defiance toward the... They would say, oh yeah? Yeah, you think you're tough, huh? Let's see. They put you in prison, and literally their goal was to break you. We are going to pound every defiant attitude out of you quickly. Here it says 10 days. You'll suffer for about 10 days. Maybe. That was a 10-day period they gave you to change. If not, okay, kill them. The letter encouraged the church of Smyrna not to give in, to remain faithful, even to death. Can you imagine what it would have been like to be a Christ follower back in that day? Question I kept asking myself as I was studying this was, I mean, it's neat. It's neat information, right? But what does that have to do with me? How does this speak to my life in any way, outside of just knowing some biblical history? Then I thought, what does persecution look like today, here, in your life, in my life? It's much more subtle, isn't it? I think it's there, though. From my perspective, it's more of an emotional, even a relational persecution that can exist, that some know is very real. Let me ask you something. When was the last time someone in your world was convinced that you were perhaps spiritually troubled? Ever have someone like that? Worried about you? Worried about maybe what you believed or what you didn't believe? Ever have that going on? Maybe it was the fact that you were questioning something that should never be questioned. Maybe you were struggling with some kind of traditional religious view on something, and they're looking at you going, no, 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 no. Don't do that. Maybe it was a theological issue. Maybe it was a moral thing. Maybe it was a sexual thing. Maybe it was about how you read the Bible. Maybe it wasn't about your beliefs. Maybe it was about the kind of friends, people, that you chose to call friends. the type of lifestyle choices you made or were making. Maybe there was a divorce. Maybe there was a remarriage. Maybe there was a coming out. Maybe there was a kid who had made some bad choices, and you were just feeling like there was someone looking at you going, I'm worried about you. But not in that way where you go, oh, thank you. It's not like that. It's that kind that you just feel like they're looking down from above and going, that's too bad. Have you ever felt? Whatever happened, you knew when things had changed. Phone stopped ringing. You walk into the room and it just feels different. They ask questions, but they're shallow. They don't want to know. What's sad is this subtle persecution often isn't coming from evil people. No government, no terrorists. It's by people who we love, who are close, who we respect. But after that line gets crossed, and whatever that thing is, there's a withholding of love. There's a withholding of affirmation. There's judgment. You get the we're praying for yous. You get the alienation. You get maybe a little bit of gossip going on around that you hear about. Let me ask you something. What could it mean to remain faithful in the midst of the persecution? Does it mean holding your tongue? Does it mean responding just in kindness toward those people? Does it mean speaking up and addressing the hurtful behavior? Does it mean walking away from that person or that situation for a time? What does remaining faithful mean for you who may be feeling persecuted? Does it mean limiting the influence that person has on you? Like, what would you have to say? If you're going to remain faithful today to whatever situation this thing might be bringing up in your mind, what would you have to say? What would you have to do? How would your life need to change in this moment for you to remain faithful to what you are about, what God is talking to you about? Let me move on to the second letter, can I? This is what the second letter says. Write this letter to the church, the angel of the church in Pergamum. This is a message from the one with the sharp, two-edged sword. I know that you live in the city where Satan has his throne, yet you have remained loyal to me. You refused to deny me even when Antipas, my faithful witness, was martyred among you there in Satan's city. But I have a few complaints against you. Why do you indulge that Balaam crowd? Don't you remember that Balaam was an enemy agent seducing Balak and sabotaging Israel's holy pilgrimage by throwing unholy parties? Why do you put up with those Nicolaitans who do the same thing? All right, any guesses on this one? What could be going on here? Again, this letter, according to John, in the vision he saw, is the voice of what seems like Jesus talking. It's his voice in this letter. He's the one with the sharp, two-edged sword. Apparently, one of the Christians there named Antipas has been martyred, been killed. But despite that, the community there is remaining loyal to their faith. The description of the city of Pergamum is interesting, though, isn't it? I find that fascinating. This is the city where Satan's throne is. Satan's city. Whoa. Pergamum was a city built around a massive citadel hill. that rose 1,000 feet above the plains, dominating the surrounding area. Many of the city's buildings, no, there's a picture in there, were built into the side of this hill, kind of terraced in. At the summit was this Acropolis with a massive altar to Zeus, Roman god. Now, when it refers to Satan's throne, we're not really sure exactly. Commonly, they think that it's a reference to one of the pagan temples that were in the city. Possibly, though, it could be just a general reference to the Roman presence in that city that was threatening the church. They had executed Antipas. They meant business. But despite Antipas's execution, violence doesn't seem to me the primary concern here in this story, in this letter. The one writing the letter seems to be very concerned about someone in their community, an influential person who is acting like Balaam. I had to go back and refresh myself on the story of Balaam. Maybe you remember it. I didn't. I had to go back. I've done messages on Balaam. I couldn't believe it. Balaam, you know, Balaam is a character in the Old Testament of the Bible, the first half. The book of Numbers tells this story, his story. He's a soothsayer. Everyone knows what a soothsayer is? No, probably not. This guy had this supernatural, he's like a supernatural mystic. He had ability to be able to bless and curse people. How's that? Balaam is approached by this king, Balak, king of Moab. He comes to Balaam and says, I need you to place a curse on the children of Israel. Children of Israel were coming from Egypt, escaping slavery, headed for the promised land, and they were going to run straight through his land. He says, they're going to devour my land. I do not want them coming through here. Curse them. Do something bad. I don't know what that would have meant. Do something bad. Balaam's sitting there going, really? You want me to curse them? But somehow God speaks to Balaam and says, don't do it. It's quite a story. And I would encourage you to read it. It's crazy. It gets super humorous. Balaam's riding on his donkey. The donkey sees an angel, freaks out. He's beating the donkey because the donkey ain't moving. Donkey starts talking at him. And in the story, he's just talking like the donkey's normal for talking. Like it's weird. Anyways, Balaam gets the point. He says, whoa, I really can't bless or I can't curse these guys. God would be really upset. So you think Balaam's a good guy. You go, wow, that a boy, you listen to God. Take care of the children of Israel. No, snake in the grass, Balaam. What does he do? He says, okay, Balak, come here. I'm going to tell you this, keep this off the record. I clean my hands of this. But if you want to take out the children of Israel, lead them into doing things they're forbidden to do. Really? Yeah. Yeah, there's a few things they shouldn't be doing. Invite them over. Get them trying some of this stuff. Sure enough. Before long, the children of Israel join in pagan practices, the practices of the people of Moab. Began engaging in worshiping the god of Baal, not the Yahweh, the god of the Bible, different god. They began engaging in sexual relations with the women of Moab. Idolatry and fornication, two things were strictly forbidden to do. And it led to their downfall. Balaam was the one who, and really indirectly, was responsible for leading the children of Israel into trouble. So here's this guy in the story, according to John's dream, Jesus, this voice, it seems, is the voice of Jesus, is saying there is someone in this church who's pulling a Balaam. Someone influential in here is doing the exact same thing that guy did. One translation says that there is an influencer in your midst and they're putting out a stumbling block. And there's people in here that are tripping over it. They're doing things they shouldn't be doing. Irenaeus, one of the early church followers, said, they're leading people to lead lives of unrestrained indulgence. Now, we do know that back at that time, eating meat that was offered to idols was a big deal. The churches were really wrestling with this thing. Let me go back to what I was saying earlier. These Romans, the Roman government would sponsor these massive festivals in which they would bring in animals and they would sacrifice them to their gods. And so a portion of the meat would be sacrificed. The rest would be offered up to be eaten by the community as kind of just shish kebabs. I don't know. Like it was like, hey, ribeyes, let's go. And so people would take part in these huge festivals and all the government officials would be coming out in flowing robes and it'd be one big party. Is it like Mardi Gras? Music plan. This was big. If you were part of this community, you were going. Huge social pressure to be there. But like I said, to be able to be participating in that was a no-no for the Christians and for the Jews. To eat the meat offered to idols at these festivities, And so there's a lot of wrestling with this. In fact, if you read the book of Corinthians, Paul's kind of talking this through. He's going, well, he has a whole bunch of rationalization on why it might be okay or whatever. But this was big. This was a big thing at this time. There's people in the church of Pergamum who apparently are being kind of going, hey, come on, it's no big deal. Come on, let's go and party. Let's go. It's all right. The food is tasty. Now, from what we can piece together, it seems that was what was going on. And it was a struggle. Someone is doing that, but meanwhile, the Christians are going, no, I don't think it's right. But they're going, man, if you don't, they're going to watch and they're going to notice if you're not coming to the party. And then the social sanctions start. And then all of a sudden, it's affecting them economically. They're just going, oh, what do we do? What do we do? But there's a few voices in there going, come on. Do it. The letter says, there's some Balaams in the camp and you're tolerating them saying these things, coaxing these people, and it's starting to affect everyone in the church. The one like Jesus in this dream says, you got to stop them. Don't make me come over there and shut them down with some harsh words. The author, the voice in this dream is pleading with them. If you have ears to hear, let them hear. Hear me out here. This is important that you're hearing what the Spirit is saying to you right now. End of story. So let me ask you the question, same question I was asking earlier. I read this story and I go, wow, that's interesting what was going on back then. But what does that have to do with me now, 2014? Is there something in the story that can speak to you today? Let me ask you something. Are there things, are there activities that you feel someone might be encouraging you to do that are jeopardizing your spiritual well-being? Is there someone in your life right now that just has that ability to talk you into doing things that are just wrong for you? Maybe this person can get you talking and gossiping about people. They just have a way bringing people up, and next thing you know, you're saying things. Afterwards, you feel a little dirty. You're going, ugh. Could there be a person that just gets you drinking too much? I got a couple people like that in my life. I love them to bits, but I got to be very careful when I'm around them. Could there be people that are tempting you to spend more money than you should influencing you, goading you perhaps into mistreating someone. Maybe you're going through something and they are posing themselves as a sympathetic ear, but it seems like after spending time with them, they get you amped up in a way that can almost be unhealthy. Is there someone in your life who just gets you spending too much time focused on the wrong priorities or not enough time on the right ones? Is there someone that just has a way of getting you to make poor choices? If so, what would it mean to no longer tolerate that situation? To turn it around? To limit the influence that that person has on you? What would you have to do? What would you have to say to that person? What parts of your life would have to change if it meant limiting their influence on you? As I talked this morning, Smyrna's challenge was to remain faithful under the persecution thing. Pergamum's challenge was to quit tolerating the negative influences in their life. I know this morning, I could have flipped this around and said, maybe you and me are the negative influences. Maybe you or me are the ones causing persecution. I could flip that right around, and maybe there's people in this room that are going, actually, I don't know what part of your story is and what you take away from these things, but I'll tell you right now, if you have ears to hear, there is likely something in these two stories that can speak to you this morning, that can challenge you with decisions you're making, with the way you're talking, with the way you're living, with the way you're influenced, or the way you're being influenced. May you have ears to hear this morning. I'm going to invite you just to take a moment right now to take a quick inventory of the people who are influencing you right now or that you're influencing. What needs to change? Could something change? Let me pray. God, this morning I ask that you would speak through this cryptic book to my life, that I would hear you, and whether it's something I need to change about the way that others are influencing me, or whether it's something I am doing that's causing the downfall, stumbling block of someone else, God, I open myself to you. I don't want to be that person. I pray that for every person here or listening to this podcast. Amen. Amen. Hey, would you have a good week this week? Would you listen to the Spirit of God this week and make a choice, make a change if you need to, all right? Let's take water to our world. Have a great week and stay warm.
Morning, everyone. My name is Vince Clausen. I'm one of the teachers here. Who is enjoying the weather right now? Who is not enjoying the weather right now? Okay, the knots have it. Who would like a trip to Mexico for two people? That's it? You? No? Nothing? Seriously, people. We have this thing where we're doing a fundraiser right now. Trip for two to anywhere WestJet flies. Anywhere WestJet flies. If you like it colder, I'm sure they go to Alaska. I don't know if they do. We have some WestJet people here. They go to Alaska? Where is it? No, not Alaska. What's the coldest place they go? Winnipeg. I grew up in Winnipeg. What are you talking about? That is the coldest place I know. Okay, warmest place they go. Warmest place they go. Cabo. There we go. You can get trip for two to Cabo. The tickets are $10. Here's the deal. There's a bunch of people here who are WestJetters in our community. That's the people I was just talking to. They've donated their time, and WestJet has this deal that if they donate their time, WestJet will donate a ticket for two anywhere. So here's the deal. You guys can buy tickets, $10 a piece, trip for two to anywhere WestJet flies. Even better, Go talk to your friends. Every one of your friends wants to go to someplace warm, right? Sell them a ticket. And here's the deal. This is the why we're doing this. We don't just do this because you want to get all the weather. We do it because every penny goes to Guatemala. I was there a while ago. In fact, a year ago this month. You look around and the kind of stuff that they're dealing with there, the malnutrition, the sewer water that's running through their yards, the gray water that's running out of their sinks, across their feet, through their chicken pen that go into the house in 2 minutes, across the other person's yard into some sort of a ditch. This is the kind of stuff we're fixing over there. So this is the last piece we're doing. If we sell all these books of tickets, we raise $10,000. All you need to do is give $10 to get a ticket or sell them. People are buying or getting 3 or 4 books, taking them to the office. They say they sell them within an hour. So we have one more week to do this. We have about 300 tickets left. They should go pretty quick. If you go to the back, see right back there? Jamie's waving her back there. He's kind of the scruffy looking guy that's a little scary. He's not that scary. So go ahead and chat with him. He'll get you set up with some books. You set up some tickets. You get some money. Trip for two anywhere WestJet flies. Can we do it? 300 tickets left, and we should be able to get them $10,000 to the community in Rio Azul. So, should be fun. Thanks, everyone.